This Sunday we begin part two of a three-part series entitled Beyond Faith, the Universal and Practical Laws of Nature. And I believe we moved through five of the universal laws last week. Perhaps today, before we continue with the universal laws and what are universal laws or universal and practical laws of nature, these, I believe, form part of the hardware of the universe that are non-negotiable. They are not beliefs. They do not have to do with doctrine or dogma. They do not have to do with any cultural interpretation of reality and the way human nature works. But they are proper to human experience itself at a certain level of awakening, and perhaps even can induce levels of awakening when they are practiced. There is a sense in which they are at the under, they undergird human nature as potentialities, but we need to practice them in order to bring them to fruition in our own lives. That is the difference between ourselves and other forms of nature that work totally on instinct. Our freedom is both a gift and a burden. So we have the freedom, the free choice, to align ourselves with the hardware, if you will, of the universe. And that, I think that's important to remember. There is a way, too, that we can condition ourselves to be more receptive to these universal laws. And I thought maybe I could talk a little bit about this before we get into our continuation of the universal laws themselves. How might we condition ourselves to be more open, more aware, or more receptive to the universal laws that are operative in the universe? Well, I think it's first very important to cultivate a sense of openness that they're there. One needs a sense of open-mindedness, an open-heartedness, that there are such laws that exist. In a sense, we are talking about trust or faith at one level in the beginning. But it is important that when we begin practicing the universal laws, that we become more aware of them, that we move beyond the faith stage. Faith is good as a beginning, but we can often take refuge in things that we do not understand or have not experienced and put that into the basket of faith, and that is when it can become very, if you will, counterproductive to the spiritual self. We were meant for science, for all different ways of knowing, and we were meant to experience our spirituality and to experience God, and that is beyond faith. But faith is certainly a good beginning, because I think faith is sort of a theological term, if you will, for a very psychological, if you will, term called openness. If one is open to receive, one has a sense of faith. Even the scientist has some level of faith, as William James mentions in his Will to Believe essay, the turn of the century, pragmatic philosopher William James, who also was one of the philosophical founders, if you will, of the 12 steps. So, cultivating an openness to non-addictive experience. That's almost redundant because the living process, the Tao, if you will, the way, is the stream in which, the ground in which, the dynamic ground in which these universal principles flow. It is a living process. So if we are captured, if you will, in the process of sleep or the process of kind of awaking death like zombies, then we will not really be aware of these universal laws that are operating. In any form of compulsive, obsessive compulsive addiction, whatever it may be, brings us out of the living process, brings us out of the way, the truth and the light, and we begin walking in asleep, in, if you will, denial, which is a psychological term for what someone who would use spiritual language would say, probably spiritual ignorance. So spiritual ignorance, or ignorance of our divine destiny, and also ignorance of our pasts, our personal pasts, is part of our problem. It was Freud, in fact, who recognized that neurosis is the result of partial memory. It is not full memory that gets us into problems. It is partial memory or no memory at all that gets us into a problem. And folks that have a problem with spirituality, it's obvious that they have partial memory of who they are or no memory at all. And denial works on the memory faculty. Okay? So neurosis occurs when we only have partial memory. Like phobias, for instance. A person that walks by an elevator and doesn't want to go in has partial memory, correct? They have to have some memory that's a dangerous place, but they don't know exactly why. Or as children, we were afraid of the dark. We didn't know exactly why specifically. We had partial memory. We know we're afraid, but we don't know exactly why. We get to a stage, hopefully, in our life where we wish to have full memory. And that is a place where eventually we have to move beyond faith. But we need faith at first, which gives us the motivation to find out our personal history, to find out our personal memory, and to believe that we will not be totally blown away by it, that we won't psychically die if we recover our memory. Are the memories that are the wounds that we carry. But there's a whole other side, which is about our divine inheritance, remembering who we are as images of the divine. Remembering who we are as images of the highest power, as images of God. And that's where the history of the religious mythologies come to play a very important role. Because it is the religious mythologies that give us a memory of our divine nature. Okay? There's where all the treasures are in the religious mythologies where our divine nature exists. However, the only way that we can get into the religious mythologies is if we begin working on stimulating our memory. So that the whole process, if you will, of recovery is a process of moving from partial memory to full memory. But not only memory of our wounds, but memory of all the positive experiences that we had in our life. And finally, memory of our divine nature. Now, isn't that good news? So, one of the ways that we can condition ourselves to break through our denial, because there's an occupational hazard to denial, and that is, if we don't want to face the wounds of our life because we're afraid of them, we also will not see the beauty. We will not see all the wonder that is at the ground of our being. And that's why it's very important to courageously take the step to explore the self and its wounds, because behind or underneath these wounds or next to them, all around them, are also the beauties of existence. If we don't play that game, If we don't play that sacred cosmic game, then what happens is, yeah, we probably won't remember fully the wounds of our life, but we also won't remember our divine nature. So that's why it's very crucial to come to a place in our life where we are open and condition ourselves to be open for self-exploration. Okay? So that would be one way we could condition ourselves to be open to the universal laws. Now, the universal laws are operating as a way of assisting our alignment and harmony, assisting our memory of our divine nature. Okay? And we continually remember them till finally they are a part of our very being. Our body, our mind, our emotions, and soul. So we literally remember to regather who we are. And we begin to then be open to the notion of God as a society. And the notion of the self as a society. Okay? We are, in terms of a self, a society of various parts, a society of pieces that work together or don't work together. The more that we align ourselves with the universal laws, the more we get connected to the social aspect of God, within and without. That God is a society. Yeah, theologians talk about the Trinity. Okay? That is a society. But there are different ways of looking at the society. There is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's a society. There is also Divine Father, Divine Mother, and Divine Child. That is another way of looking at the society. There is body, mind, spirit, emotions, soul. That is a society. And what happens in with addictive behaviors or compulsive behaviors that are all about denial, by the way, they're all strategies. Addiction really is no more or no less than a strategy to avoid our partial memory that is painful. That make sense? Addictions are no more or no less than elaborate strategies that we use to avoid the partial memory. That partial memory that we do not recognize. Okay? We recognize it enough that we can medicate it through some process. Relationship addiction, sexual addiction, substance abuse, eating disorder. We recognize it enough to where we begin acting on it, but we don't recognize it fully. We don't know exactly why we are addicted to a certain form of behavior. Even, I would even say, addicted to spiritual ignorance. So it's important to stay open as a way of conditioning. It's important also just to become aware of the different levels our being is operative on. And I've spoken to you in past lectures about the four quadrants of our being. It's important to recognize that we're operating in a lot of different levels. Now, from reality is hierarchical. Spirituality certainly being the highest reality, including the material world. Get out of your dualism. There's no way that we can really get in touch with the universal laws if we continue to be dualistic. The spiritual realm, which is hierarchical, includes the material. But the material does not necessarily include the spiritual. Okay? So, pantheism does not work. Panentheism does work. Because it always recognizes a transcendent force which includes all of the world going downward. Reality is hierarchical. That's part of the hardware of the universe too. There are stages of development, stages of awareness. So, being in touch with the different quadrants and recognizing that there is a material quadrant, there is a mental quadrant, an emotional quadrant, and spiritual quadrant. Okay? There are four quadrants. There are probably more, but since we can't, the quadrant is four, so if we start dealing with more, we're going to get pretty elaborate. Some people talk about seven levels in the Oriental levels of being. Some of those systems that are very elaborate systems go to the number seven. But to simplify it, we can talk about four. So one has the material level, the everyday level that we can see, touch, feel, empirically analyze, etc. And then we have the mental level, right? Emotional level, and then the spiritual level. If we begin to operate from a spiritual level, we have to recognize that it includes the mental and the emotional and the physical. It includes those. It is not separate. It is not separate. We get into dualism, we are really at the first stage, and we're not at the spiritual level at all. And that creates a lot of pain for ourselves and others. We can condition ourselves to take a look at where we are in our level of maturity in each of these levels. Take an honest kind of look. So actually, what this means is we begin to be super conscious of ourselves. Not just conscious, but super conscious of our beings. And that is the way that we can transcend. That's another definition of transcendence, in fact. Okay? Another definition of spirituality, excuse me, is transcendence. It is the transcendent aspect of our human nature. Okay. Universal law number six. At a certain level, the emptier I become, the more I can be filled. At a certain level, the emptier I become, the more I can be filled. And that's a universal law. It's operative on the material level. The emptier a cup, the more a cup can be filled. But it also operates on the mental level. The more I can empty myself of prejudice and judgments, because I can clutter my mind with so much of what I believe is true, I can't fill anything. That's the person that comes to a place or a gathering or reads a book or hears something, and if it fits with what they like, they'll accept it. If it doesn't fit, they won't accept it. And that's okay. There are many who operate on that level of awakening, and that's okay. But the bottom line is, if I can't empty myself, I will not be able to fill myself with more information. So it operates very subtly on the mental level. Emotionally, it operates in the level of freedom and intimacy. If I don't allow someone space in a relationship, they will not be able to grow, and they will also not be able to love. Okay? So emotionally it works as well. So the emptier I can be, the more I can be filled. Okay? And on the spiritual level, of course, it operates at the level of ego. The more I can empty myself of my ego and my egoistic concerns, the more I can be filled, if you will, with the ego of the great I am. The great I am. The great ego. And be then conscious of the super concerns of humanity, which are the same as my own concerns at a certain level of awakening. So there are different levels of emptying, but it is only really the healthy ego that can feel comfortable enough with surrendering. Okay? So I don't recommend surrendering the ego unless you work on getting your ego healthy. And the way to get your ego healthy is to work on those partial memories I was talking about, because an unhealthy ego is usually so fraught with partial memory, with pain, that they kind of walk around traumatized with a chip on their shoulder, real defensive. You know, someone who's highly argumentative and defensive, okay?
They've got to get their piece in. No, it's not this way, it's that way. I'm just being assertive. Right? That's usually a sign of a pretty defensive ego that's wounded and so needs, you know, assertiveness is an art. And it takes a long time to be assertive without anyone recognizing it. It's an art to be assertive without someone really getting all their feathers rustled. But usually feathers will be rustled when one is attempting to defend that ego that is not yet healthy. And so do all the work you can on strengthening your ego. And that sometimes takes an experimental process of asserting yourself if that's where you need the balance, or shutting up if that's where you need the balance. Okay? Because let's face it, in predominantly patriarchal culture, women are devalued when they speak, and men are devalued when they do not speak. See, there's a political nature to this social mechanism that keeps us asleep to our universal laws. Okay? Women who have violence inflicted on them are more in our society politically given the right to hurt themselves. Men are more politically given the right to hurt others when they've been abused. So once you have these systems, you have these political systems that are and social systems that are already distorted, it's hard to see who we really are in our human nature. Okay? So the emptier I become, the more filled I can be, is a universal law operating on every level. Universal law will always operate at the most simple level and as well the most complex. And it is not owned by any particular religion or belief. Okay? No one has ownership but God of the universal principles. The highest power has ownership. No other being has ownership. No other society but the society of God. The seventh universal law. What we do not own about ourselves, we will project onto others in the universe. What we do not own about ourselves, we will project onto others in the universe. And it starts quite early, doesn't it? I hate that teacher. She doesn't like me. You know? And it might have been that the teacher was quite unhealthy mentally and emotionally. People that are in the teaching field have an occupational hazard of not working on their own stuff and avoiding their own stuff by teaching others. But of course, then they never teach, because the only way that something is really accepted and internalized as a teaching is if someone who is doing the teaching is working on their own stuff. But what we do not own about ourselves, we project onto others in the universe. That means, and things will flag up constantly. Whatever we have to work on will always flag up to us, which is another universal law I think we've already talked about. But I will project feelings onto others that are actually a mirror of the stuff inside of myself. Like, I can't stand an arrogant person. Hate arrogance. And the reason why is because the arrogant defect in me or the arrogant place in me only is mirrored by someone who is arrogant. I recognize that because I am that. And we can judge what we actually... So what we judge as an enemy usually means as a part of our psyche. So that's the universal law. So see, in the reality of God, there are no enemies. There is no opposition. In the reality of God, all is sacred. All is working as part of the harmonious Tao. It is only in the level of duality that we have opposition and enemy, because what we have not dealt with, we mirror onto someone else. So if whatever I judge, if I judge anybody, let's say I judge someone to be too thin or too fat or too dark or too light, all I'm doing is mirroring what I have not accepted about myself at a lot of different levels. So in the reality of God, there is no opposition. There is no conflict. It is all in harmony. Okay? So that which I project onto others, usually I cannot own about myself. Now, just a word about this. It does not mean that when I was a child, if I was victimized, that I need to forgive that enemy of victimization. I don't think that's at all what I'm saying. Okay? So if ever you are at levels where you are already a child, in our society, women and children are the ones that are most victimized. Okay? But as the book on boyhood will allow some of you to recognize, if you have not, that men too have been victimized big time, but they are not as comfortable to talk about it. That's why in therapy, it is very rare and very courageous for a man to come into therapy. It is more socially acceptable still to this day for a woman to go into therapy. Because men have much more of a denial mechanism at work. As I've told you before, I've worked with men for a long time before they even know that they're depressed. Because the level of denial is so deep that it takes a while for them to even recognize that they're depressed because they've been denying all the pain. And then acting it out, getting angry, getting violent, projecting all of that stuff that's inside of themselves. Okay, so remember that what I'm not suggesting in terms of everything that we project is about a shadow of our own psyche. I'm not suggesting that we were never victimized and that we have a lot of issues and that we need to say no to that victimization and be angry about that. That's one of the first rules of boundary setting. I think it really takes anger to set a clear boundary. If one does not have a goodly amount of anger and self-righteousness to protect the child inside, one won't maintain a boundary. One has to have a good, healthy sense of fierceness and protection of one's inner child to be angry, to say, no, I will not allow this to happen. But eventually, once we begin to set the boundaries in place, then we can begin seeing that how on many levels we project a lot of our anger and judgments out there as a way of protecting what we haven't dealt with on the inside. So every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong with us. And the more we begin to have a barometer within ourselves, then we begin to do as Socrates exhorted, know thyself. That is where the freedom lies, in knowing ourselves. The shadow side of ourselves is really a gift that allows us to deal with unfinished business. Now, how can we find that shadow self or that secret self? We have to write it out. We have to act it on the stage, sometimes in the drama of therapy. Okay? We maybe have to journal it. The secret self will always appear in the dreams. Our secret self, the self that we're hiding. And the secret self will always show itself in acting out behavior. Or acting in behavior. Okay. So much for law number 7. Okay. Number 8. We will experience the power of loss to the extent that we hold on to the thing lost. We will experience the pain of loss to the extent that we hold on to the thing lost. Universal law. Parting is such sweet sorrow, Shakespeare said. It is important that we grieve what we have lost. And in terms of conditioning to this universal law, that we will experience the pain of loss in proportion to how much we hold on to it. It is important that we do some grief work, and when we do our grief work, we can make a list. And I suggest a list, first, of a hierarchy of losses. What is the most important loss? What is the least important loss? I also suggest that we be very responsible and aware of those losses that we incurred or that we partially and or fully caused, or those losses that we had no power. It was not in our power to lose them. It's important in doing grief work to have some kind of hierarchy of losses so that we can really do some good work. And the more we hold on to something in terms of a loss usually tells me that that flags family of origin stuff. The more that someone is holding on to a loss, the more it goes back all the way to the beginning. Isn't that true? So if one is holding on to a relationship, it's not that relationship right now that you're holding on to. You're holding on to every person or every person, place, or thing that said goodbye to you that you couldn't control. Now that's power. Okay? And that will incur a lot of pain, because the more tightly we hold on to it, the more we hold all that stuff inside us and we cannot release it. And the more we also maintain our spiritual ignorance and denial at really what has taken place. So the converse to that law is that the more I just move through the pain of my losses. Now, there are a lot of men that don't even know what this is about. They don't have any losses because they've had so many darn open doors, they haven't allowed themselves to experience that loss. Okay? A lot of my, in my therapy with men, all those doors are so open. There's a million doors open, just a little creak, you know? Just a little bitty opening that they can always go back to that place. Okay? The thing is, if we don't allow ourselves to let go, we cannot get what we need, which is much, much more on our plate in terms of our life. But there's that existential angst, right? That when we let go of that, will something take its place? So we like to bargain, don't we? If I give this, give me that. If I give this up, maybe I can take this. Or maybe what I can do is hold on to this. I'm going to leave this, but I'm going to make sure I got this first. Okay, good. I don't need you anymore. Good. Good. All right. Oh, this isn't working out. Okay, give me another one. Okay, hold on. Okay, there. Now it's easier. And that's really how we move through our life in terms of our attachments. And Buddha knew, and Jesus knew, and Krishna knew, that the only way that we would really get rid of our neurosis, our partial memory, our pain, would be to really let go of what we're holding on to so tightly that would actually give us our happiness. Now, that takes a level of trust. In the beginning, it takes a leap of faith. But to stay at the level of faith is no longer operative as we move toward the third millennium. Okay? Just to stay at the level of faith is to really get stuck. Because one needs to get beyond that to experience. So one experiences intimacy. One experiences love. One experiences God in the world. Not only kind of waiting with one's eyes closed to see heaven in a future kingdom. The kingdom is now. The kingdom is here. The kingdom is amongst all of us, but we do not see it. And the way that we can see it, the way that we can allow it to usher in, is to begin to move through a lot of that partial denial that we have, to let go of those things we hold so tightly onto. And that is really the meaning of addiction at some level, isn't it? We're holding on to whatever we're holding on tightly to, chances are that is very meaningful. It's very meaningful for the spiritual life. For the spiritual life. But it's important to have a support system. You know, we're human beings and we're very fragile and we need a support system. At the same time, we need to be allowed to feel pain. It's an art. Anyone who has me in therapy knows I don't rescue. Because there's an important quality where one must stand and feel that that pain and choose, if you don't take that choice to take that leap to become a knight of faith, as Kierkegaard said, you will not do it. You need someone close by, but you don't need someone keeping you from what you need. Or we maintain our eternal puer. We'll maintain our eternal childhood or our adolescence, and we never really will be able to grow at all. And so any guide or helper, it is important that they allow us to experience mature aloneness, and that has to happen in the crucible of some pain. But it is definitely not as much pain as one will have if they hold on to stuff so desperately and not to let go, to move beyond, take responsibility for their life. Time maybe for one more. We will find the truth if we let go of our opinions. We will find the truth if we let go of our opinions. Seng Tsang, Chinese sage around 606 AD, but actually Plato, and all of the seers, all of the sages, Plato knew this, because when Plato, Plato's whole cave experience, you know, Plato's cave and trying to move to the light of the one, to move beyond faith. Pistfor Plato is faith, and it's really not, it's only half the story. It's only a partial seeing of the truth. We will find the truth if we let go of our opinions. Yeah, and opinion is also, that is another word, I believe, for pistis. I hope it's been so long. Maybe doke. It's been so long since I've been, when my face was in the plate of Greek. We will find the truth if we let go of our opinions. We will find the truth if we let go of our opinions. Opinions really create a kind of stuck place. And opinions are okay, you know. Opinions are like the adolescence form of truth. It's important that we have an ego, you know, and the self says, I believe this and I like this and I don't like that and I don't like spinach, but I like this and I like, you know, I like this kind of ice cream and I don't like that. Okay, it's all right to have opinions when we're first growing up. But if we're going to really understand mature aloneness and mature spirituality, opinions are really become a block. They become a spiritual blockade to our growth. Are you with me? So opinions are good when we're developing as a self. But they can become quite boring after a while. Because if we have opinions, we kind of get stuck and we don't really try new things. And that was that openness I was telling you about. You know, the conditioning ourselves, to condition ourselves to the spiritual laws. So the more we hold on to opinions, the more truth eludes us and eludes us. Because in truth, there is no opinion, it just is. And that's a universal law. So, see, opinions are about likes and dislikes. Universal laws is about being. It is non-negotiable. Opinions come and go. I might have an opinion about something today, and I might change my opinion tomorrow, right? But truth is. Truth is about being. And sometimes in the early stages of spiritual awakening, we can make the mistake of equating an opinion with truth, or a like or a dislike with truth. I like this, therefore it's true. Well, that's okay for a 14-year-old. But once we go further on the journey, we recognize that opinions can really be blockades to, of course, what I'm talking about is non-duality consciousness. And non-duality consciousness gives us access to the universal laws. All right, we'll continue next week.